Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Maggie Shipstead's new novel, Great Circle, tracks the lives of Marion Graves and her twin brother, Jamie, from Prohibition-era Missoula to wartime Britain, from the cold of Alaska to the cap of Antarctica, as Marion chases her dream of becoming the first pilot to circumnavigate the globe north to south. But it isn't just entire landscapes, continents that Shipstead writes of here. She spans the whole biographies, intertwining Marion's story with that of Hadley Baxter, a young actress living in modern-day Los Angeles. Maggie Shipstead is the New York Times bestselling author of the novels Astonish Me and Seating Arrangements. Again, the new novel is Great Circle, and it is a wonderful pleasure to welcome Maggie Shipstead to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
Oh, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, the obvious question is, what brought you down this path of wanting to tell us the story of Marion Graves and her love of flight?
Well, the sort of original seed of it happened in fall of 2012. I was in New Zealand and I'd been traveling and I thought I would work on this project I had going. I was sort of waiting for edits on Astonish Me. And the project I was writing just sort of died. I just lost all momentum and couldn't get anywhere. And so I was at the airport sort of feeling sorry for myself. And there was a statue there of this pilot, Gene Batten, who was the first person to fly solo from the UK to New Zealand in 1936. And it was kind of one of those moments where when you know, you know. And I was just like, I will write a book about a pilot, a female pilot. And I didn't start working for another 2 years, but I had it in my head that that's what I would do. And then I can't ever plan or outline my books. So then in fall of 2014, when I had just moved to LA, I kind of sat down and wrote what is still kind of the opening of the book and was the first thing I wrote.
Well, that's interesting because it answers the question that I ultimately had for you, which is, without the planning and outlining aspect of it, did you know that it was going to take such broad a scope, that it was going to be as epic in nature as it is?
Yeah, absolutely not. I had written my previous two books kind of in under a year each, and I sort of had this notion of myself as someone who just sort of tosses off a book in a year. And so I thought that that would be the case for this as well. I thought it might be slightly longer than my other books, but yeah, I sort of immediately made things difficult for myself because I was like, you know, this should start with the launch of a ship in 1909. And then I pretty quickly had the idea for Hadley. And so then I had two threads going. And then as I went forward, I had sort of this idea for these sections called Incomplete Histories, where I would sort of, you know, go back in time and zoom forward and include all the history of Missoula or quite a lot of history of aviation. And so it really kind of sprawled semi out of control as I worked and was certainly not the plan. But, you know, I kind of gave myself over to it and the book became something that was about vastness and complexity and how do you sort of wrangle that and how do you measure yourself against it. So I embraced it for the most part, although I had plenty of days, particularly maybe when I was 2 years in and I realized I wasn't halfway through a first draft. I'd written, you know, 450 pages and I knew I had at least that much more to go. And that was a hard day.
You mentioned Hadley, the character of Hadley, Hadley Baxter, who is a modern day actress who ultimately plays Marion in the movie of her life. And her story emerges very quickly in the novel. And you see how the two are going to play with each other. There are different ways to describe this, of course, of having dual narratives. But that word of a dual, of how do you balance that out? Because Marion always really does take center stage.
Yeah, and intentionally so. I mean, that was one of the biggest challenges of writing the book was sort of figuring out what kind of balance I wanted between them and having kind of enough Hadley, but not too much Hadley. I've heard voice I've been describing as acidic. Like, I think it's something that kind of cuts through the bulk of the novel. And I wanted that variety, but I also wanted this sort of lens on how much is lost when a person disappears or when a person dies. And so, you know, Hadley's trying to reconstruct Marion's life, and partly by virtue of being a celebrity, so somebody who people think they know and people think, you know, construct all these narratives around. She sort of has this instinct that people can't really be known from the outside. And, you know, when Hadley's biopic is being made about Marion, Marion's been gone for 65 years and she left behind a notebook, which then becomes a novel, which becomes a movie. So it's all sort of this game of telephone. But I did have to sort of move Hadley's pieces around in the book, and I took a couple different approaches to them. So that was some of my kind of most involved revision, as kind of the drafts ticked by.
And what is, what comes out, and without giving too much away, but what Marion and Hadley have in common is the loss, right? Is that the loss of their parents and the weirdness of growing up in that.
Yeah, they're both sort of trying to figure out, you know, how do I live my life, which is something we're all grappling with, of course, in different ways. And they have enough in common on sort of a concrete level that Hadley sees Marion in some ways as like, Marion's life is almost like tarot cards to Hadley. She's sort of wondering what's in it for her, and what she can take from Mary, what's left of Marion's life. And to her, I mean, I think what she really envies about Marion is Marion's sense of purpose. You know, Marion knew she had to fly, and Hadley's not really sure what she has to do. You know, she's under this crushing pressure of, you know, public scrutiny and different expectations. But yeah, they're both, I think by virtue of the loss, as you say, being orphaned, and they're both raised by their uncles, they're sort of set up to be kind of always seeking something that's that can't really be found.
And Hadley is, she knows Marion's story because she read it as a kid. I mean, she saw this book and picked it up, and there was a connection there.
Yeah, just kind of by happenstance. And then years later, someone gives her the book and says, you know, we're making a movie of this. And it also seems to her like a sign. I think Hadley is definitely someone who believes the universe is telling her things.
Let us talk for a moment about the character of Marion, because she is really so independent and against all odds. And several times throughout the book, this question comes up of why. What is driving this character to want this? Whether it be to fly, to do what she is doing, the various ways that she makes money, and then ultimately that brings her to the war, and then brings her to want to do this accomplishment of circumnavigating the globe north to south. That question of why comes up a lot. I assume it's a question you had to answer pretty early on.
You know, when I wrote the first draft, so the first draft took 3 years and 3 months, and it was a slender 980 pages, which eventually shrank quite a bit to make the finished book. But you know, in some ways, I didn't really question it. My brother was a pilot in the Air Force, or he just left the Air Force, but he stopped flying a while ago. But I had seen someone who, as a child, just knew they had to fly. And my impression is this is pretty common amongst pilots. There's just something that speaks to them, and they know they have to do it. So I felt comfortable having Marion react that way to sort of her first up-close look at some biplanes. But this question of, and she has this sort of feral childhood, she and her brother, and are free to follow their impulses. And she doesn't really consider that there might be any limitations on her, or that her gender might be a factor until she's older and is trying to fly. But it was funny, the question of why she would fly around the world north-south really kind of bedeviled my agent when she read the first draft. And she was my first reader, and she was just like, I don't understand why she would want to do it. And
right.
To me, for some reason, it just made sense. I think part of that's that I've done quite a bit of sort of polar travel and encountered people who just do things like this because they feel they have to. And I think people have a vision of themselves sort of making a journey like this or an accomplishment, and even the sort of obscurity of it, the fact that there's no rational reason to them is persuasive. Like, that's part of the why. And so, I mean, but because of my agent's befuddlement, I did have to kind of dig into it a little bit and think that through more clearly.
Well, it's a natural reaction when people say, I'm going to climb Mount Everest. And you think to yourself, oh, why are you going to do that? Like, you don't have to. Why would you want to do that?
I think it might be one of those things where there's sort of, there are two types of people in the world, you know,
right?
People who don't need the why and people who wonder about it.
When you look at all that she goes through and the constants in her life are her brother, Jamie, and her friend, mm-hmm. Caleb. And these are guideposts. These are people who she's working with, and they are far from straight arrows in the sense of, you know, that they have their own issues, certainly, but yet that those three really operate together in many ways. Maybe not together, but they operate in a way that help one another.
Mm-hmm.
They're reliant on one another.
Yeah. I mean, I think because they're friends, or, you know, two siblings and a friend since childhood and through this sort of unorthodox childhood, they really understand each other better than anyone else kind of ever can or can catch up with all this shared experience. And I think they all... You know, Marion and Jamie are twins, but they're quite different. And I wanted them to sort of balance each other out. And I think, you know, Jamie is defined by his gentleness and Marion's defined by her boldness. And I think each gives the other license to be that way. And then Caleb, being sort of the third point of the triangle, fulfills a similar function in a way. He's sort of, his friendship is part of what allows them to be individuals and vice versa. But yeah, because I don't plan, you know, sort of casually introduced Caleb as I was writing through their childhood without thinking through how important he would be over the course of the book. But what I find with my sort of writing method is that when I hit problems later on, often the solutions are embedded in the earlier part of the book. And in some ways, that's how Caleb functioned for me as a character. I'd always bring him back, and he helps Marion out of some tight spots as well.
Right.
And so he was important to me sort of functionally as well as emotionally.
He is there when they need him.
Exactly. Yeah.
When you look at the overall story that you wanted to tell, I mean, it is very much about flight. It is about Marion. It is about gender. And those are all things that are certainly addressed here. And when you do that balance of figuring it out, Marion is a very complex character. And was that complexity apparent to you from the very beginning? Or did that emerge as you continued down the path?
Yeah, it's certainly emerged. I mean, I think writing a character is a process of getting to know someone. And, you know, I'm always going back as I understand the character better, going back and looking at the earlier parts to say, you know, is this consistent with who this person is, or at least who they become? But, you know, in some ways, she was a little bit of a cipher to me until fairly late in the process. And so I really had to sort of actively think about her and who she is. And kind of what I came around to was, you know, here's someone who prioritizes freedom probably above all else, and sometimes at fairly great cost. And I think part of what drives the book is that decision to lead an unorthodox life just can't be one decision. It's really, you know, ongoing decisions. And she sort of maintains this state of vigilance against sort of the encroachments of domesticity. You know, she's determined to live her life the way she wants. And so that was really what I would sort of go back to as I wrote her.
Because there always seems to be this confusion as to why she is doing things, and she questions herself, and yet she's doing very bold things, but there is this question game of, is this right, is this wrong, what would have happened if, ... Would you seem to enjoy writing about?
Yeah, I do. Well, and I think this is actually, I've maybe never really thought about this, but Hadley, you know, when she's under this pressure from her celebrity, she'll have these almost tantrums. Like, there's a scene very early in the book where she's in this high profile romance with her co-star, and she leaves a nightclub with this pop star and kind of is photographed and blows up her relationship. And it's almost like a lashing out or proving something. And I think Marianne has moments like that as well, where, you know, she feels these restrictions and she kind of has to make this semi-grand assertion. You know, she has to sort of run away or fly away or do something, make a big change, almost as sort of this, I don't know, almost like, I want to use the word tantrum, which I don't think is quite right, but just a big gesture toward her independence.
Maggie Shipstead is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel is Great Circle. It is published by Knopf. There's a line early on in the novel, very early on in the novel, where you write, people at least think they know about Amelia Earhart, even though they don't. It's not really possible. That really struck with me as sort of a tone, not only about Amelia Earhart, but also about the other pilots and people that you talk about from history that are included in this narrative. Give us a sense of how you address those who came before and after Marion Graves.
Yeah, well, it's funny, you know, when I was writing the book and people would ask what it was about, and I'd say it's about the female pilot disappears trying to fly around the world north south, and the universal response was, oh, like Amelia Earhart. And of course, you know, it is kind of like Amelia Earhart, but I'd be like, no, it isn't. Even though Amelia Earhart was very much part of the initial inspiration, just because I'm really fascinated by the way we sort of metabolize her as a culture. You know, there's so many famous female pilots in the 20s and 30s, like really household names, you know, people followed aviation records, you know, for speed or altitude or whatever. And so she was kind of one of many in a way. She's probably the most famous even then, but she's really the only one we remember, you know, or children dress up as for Halloween, that sort of thing. And I think she almost certainly crashed in the ocean and drowned. Like, there's no, I don't think any of the castaway scenarios actually make sense. That sort of question of why that's so hard for us to accept was one of my sort of guiding questions from the beginning. And then, yeah, it became important to me to sort of situate Marion in a reality or in history. So, you know, yeah, Amelia Earhart is an acknowledged person in the book, and these other pilots are as well. And someone asked me also when I was in the middle of writing it, if I could describe the book in one word, what it would be. And I said, scale. You know, how do you measure one life against the planet? How do you measure one life against time and all these other lives being lived? And so part of how I wanted to get at that was to show how much else there's going on around Marion. And so that was part of why I brought in sort of the history of flight and of these other pilots into the fictional narrative.
You also write, of course, about Charles Lindbergh and the concern that keeps on being brought up, rightfully so, is the anti-Semitic past, which is brought into it as well, which just sort of questions all of the of who we think of as our heroes, which factors into Marion's thoughts about this too, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, Lindbergh's a really early example of, I mean, talk about squandering your capital. Like, there's never been a bigger hero. And then, you know, as the war started, I think people were responding less to his anti-Semitism and sort of affinity for the Nazis than they were for his non-interventionism. But, you know, like, things that had been named after him, they changed the names again. And he was really rightfully disgraced, and then spent the rest of his life sort of trying to claw his way back from that. And yeah, I think, you know, we'll never sort of learn our lesson about being cautious about having heroes, but his life, I think, was fascinating in many ways. And one thing that struck me as I learned more about aviation in writing the book was just the sheer speed at which that technology changed the world. You know, the fact that Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic in 1927 in like a glorified picnic basket. And then he was present at the launch of Apollo 11. You know, what a sweeping change in the course of one lifetime. And yeah, just a really, really strange person.
You do this marvelous thing throughout a novel, as you say, this was, you know, 900 plus pages originally and pared down to just over 600. But every once in a while in the narrative, there is an incomplete history of ... And you pack so much in, but it comes, oh, by the way, this is what you should know for the next section. Was that always part of the process, or was that sort of giving in to, all right, I have to tighten this up a bit?
No, they all used to be longer.
There used to be more incomplete histories.
There was one of Antarctica, which was one of the biggest things that I cut, although it was probably only 7 pages. Most of the cutting I did to cut really 25% of the book's length, because the, you know, pagination's a little different when it's still manuscript, was just small pervasive cuts. And with a book that long, if you cut a little bit from every page, you end up cutting a lot of pages. So yeah, they were always in there. I think I had the ideas as I was writing along and got to Missoula, and I wanted to include, for some reason, lost to time, this sort of account of how Missoula is the lake bed of this ancient glacial lake, which used to be 2,000 feet deep and 2,000 miles square and shaped the whole Pacific Northwest. So that was really the start. And then once I'd written one, you know, it doesn't make sense to just have one. So they popped up throughout the book and would sort of allow me to convey a lot of information really at a clip. And I really enjoyed writing them, and I liked the effect of them. But yeah, the Antarctica one came about 80% of the way through the book. And my editor's point was that once people have read 500 pages, they don't really want to like go back to Pangaea.
Well, maybe a fair point. Sure.
Yeah, she was right.
There are some just wonderful lines in here. I just want to throw a couple of them to you. Eddie, who is a peripheral character, but a very important one because it's Marion's navigator on the trip. Eddie says, "You always are somewhere. You just have to figure out where. The place you want to go exists. You just have to find it." That can be so universal and used in so many different ways to describe life.
It's true. I think Eddie, you know, is a navigator, and there's so much sort of metaphorical freight attached to navigation, I think, for good reason. And that was something I was playing with. But I also, you know, thought about it in a literal sense too. And during the course of writing this book, I did a lot of freelancing for travel magazines, which is how I got to a lot of the places that Marion goes. And in traveling to some of these more remote corners of the earth, it just, that sort of literal fact really struck me, where I was like, this is here. Like, this weird remote corner of Antarctica exists. Like, you just have to find a way to get there. It's there. And then, yeah, that is also true of life in other ways.
There's another character that is talking to Hadley and says, "A piece of advice for you, knowing what you don't want is just as useful as knowing what you do, maybe more." Well, yeah, exactly, right?
Mm-hmm. Very helpful.
And that comes through for both Marion and for Hadley. in this novel.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
When you think of the duality of those stories, I mean, one of the things I thought of is that Marion can become a hero by doing this and become a celebrity. And yet there you have Hadley as a celebrity. And I don't think I'm misinterpreting this, but is pretty miserable about that aspect, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And she doesn't see any alternatives. You know she's not happy, but she doesn't have any idea what to do about it. I think Hadley is, at least at the beginning of the book, yeah, profoundly lost.
So Marion figures out a way to deal with that, though. And the assumption is that I assume Hadley figures that out as well.
I hope so. You know, it's funny. I never really think beyond the boundaries of the book. Mm-hmm. And so I think Hadley ends the book in a better place than she begins it. But I remember when I was first on tour for Seating Arrangements, my first book, and people would be like, well, what happens to Livia? Like after the book. And I was like, I don't know. You know, like she's eaten by a shark. What do you want? I hope for the best for Hadley, but I don't know.
So I have to ask this question because it did strike me many times during the novel. Hadley talks about the moment where she's standing on that stage with the Oscar in her hand.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever think for a moment, okay, I'm going to write that scene?
No, I didn't. And I'm not actually sure I resolved in my head whether or not this movie she's making over the course of the book, the biopic of Marion, I've never answered the question for myself of whether it's going to be a good movie.
Because it has some shaggy lineage to it.
Exactly, yeah. And it's also the type of movie that's very difficult to make. Like there's a biopic of Amelia Earhart maybe 10 years ago with Hilary Swank, and it's fine. You know, I kind of think this movie that all this work and money has gone into will also probably be like, okay.
The new novel is Great Circle. It is published by Knopf. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.